Welcome to session 275 of Sunstone. We're going to start right on time here, and as you look like a pretty astute audience, you probably notice that I am not, in fact, Brian Waterman, who, it's true, and he is not going to be here for this symposium, but he asked me to be here in his stead, so I'm going to read his remarks and also moderate the panel. So my name is Cammie Hill, and I'm a former editor of Student Review and a correspondent of Brian Waterman. That's sort of my qualifications for being here. And the rest of the people on the panel are much more qualified than I. We have Gary Bergera, who works at Signature Books, and Stacey Burton, who is an English professor at the University of Nevada, and Mark Brewer, who is a Japanese historian who will soon be teaching at Boston University.
Boston College.
Boston College. There are a lot of Boston, you know, higher education institutions, so. Okay. So Brian's, I talked to Brian a little bit yesterday about doing this, and he did recognize the irony of calling people to do Mormon cultural studies while saying he wished someone else would do it instead. So on that note, I will please forgive the papers in the first person, so just kind of bear with me for that. So we'll start off, and Thoughts Toward a New Mormon Cultural Studies by Brian Waterman. First, the reason I thought this panel might be useful. A decent number of my friends, many but not all part of my age group, some but not all being trained professionally to study history or literature or both, are running away from Mormon studies faster than Monty Python's Kniggets run pell-mell from the nasty, horrible monster with pointy teeth like this in the search for the Holy Grail. The reason? Unless one is consciously or unconsciously an apologist, and sometimes even then, the practice of Mormon studies has become a dangerous pastime. For some, especially those who care what their local or general church leaders think about them, this serves as an adequate deterrent. Others, though, run away because they simply perceive Mormon studies practitioners to be bored or boring. With few exceptions, current methods of literary and cultural analysis have not cropped up in sessions at this or other symposia and conferences. There are exceptions at this conference, including session 152, 255, 262, and 334. There you go. I can think of a handful of other sessions from years past that would fall under the rubric of cultural studies. David Knowlton's studies of testimony bearing as a cultural form of Mormon masculinity, Kathleen Flake's explication of sacrament rituals, Joanna Brooks' critique of Terry Tempest Williams' cultural colonialism in Refuge, or her prolegomena to any future Mormon studies, her contribution to the graduate student issue of Dialogue we co-edited in 1997. Many other Sunstone sessions, though, remain committed, and I'm not suggesting they shouldn't be, to haggling over the truth of this or that principle, or the true telling of this or that event. Very little attention is paid here or elsewhere in Mormon studies to what Mormon things mean in larger cultural context, or to how meaning is created in Mormon cultural context. For several years, the alumni of Student Review and others have sought to spice up Sunstone with humorous and sometimes analytically serious discussions of Mormon popular culture. From BYU Studios Productions' Death in the 1970s Church Film to Lex de Azevedo's Pop Music and Morality. These sessions emerge, I think, from a fundamental tension we've been brought up with between Mormon and American pop cultures. Although none of us are pursuing our quirky little insights and parodies in print, a few lapsed Mormon friends who teach English at secular universities have launched serious studies of popular representations of polygamy, both in anti-polygamy fiction and in the creation of the Western novel. Richard Bushman moves in a direction I find interesting when he asks the question, was Joseph Smith a gentleman? And the answers to such questions will be most informative, I think, if we don't have to worry about whether or not the answer matters in the sense that the truth of the gospel hangs on such cultural categories. Still, despite these recent gestures toward a new Mormon cultural studies, it's striking to me that the most interesting cultural analyses of Mormonism in recent years, and almost the only attempts at a genuine cultural history of Mormonism, have come from professional historians with no LDS backgrounds or ties. Paul Johnson's readings of Joseph Smith's Patriarchal Politics, Nathan Hatch's study of populism and print culture among early Mormons and the democratization of American Christianity, John Butler's discussion of Mormon syncretism in Awash in a Sea of Faith, Colleen McDaniel's material cultural analysis of Mormon temple garments, Lawrence Moore's treatment of leisure and popular entertainment at Brigham Young's Salt Lake City, part of his fascinating book, Selling God, John Burke's too easily dismissed by Mormons account. You know, it would be a lot easier if he didn't have to list everything that everyone wrote.
Too easily dismissed by Mormons' account of Joseph Smith's hermetic memory, which better than any work I know places early Mormons in the context of American popular culture of the era. These works approach Mormon culture and history in ways few Mormon historians have attempted. The difference isn't simply a matter of belief versus disbelief. My intuition is that these historians carry less baggage than Mormons do, either offensive or defensive. They seem not at all invested or even interested in telling the truth of faith claims by ordering events and digging for warts and all. They seem, to me, simply to be better able to read Mormonism as a culture, as a piece of a larger American cultural fabric, rather than something isolated, distinct, cut off from the world the way early Utah Mormons wanted to be before the coming of the railroad. Unfortunately for us, most of these studies emerge from the study of 19th century American culture. Some of the quirkiest Mormon cultural institutions, the Donnie and Marie Show, say, or BYU championship football, remain untouched by rigorous cultural analysis. Perhaps it would be useful to define a few terms before offering my personal wish list of titles and turning the time over to the panel. In defining terms like New Mormon history, cultural studies, and new historicism, or new literary historicism, at the risk of oversimplification, but for the sake of convenience, I draw on four representative and relatively recent works. Mike Quinn's Introduction to the New Mormon History, the editor's introduction to Jackson Lear's and Richard Fox's anthology, The Power of Culture, the introduction to the Rutledge anthology, The Cultural Studies Reader, and the just-published book, Practicing New Historicism, by Catherine Gallagher and Stephen Greenblatt. Defining New Mormon History, courtesy of Mike Quinn. Beginning in the 1950s and 60s, but hitting full throttle in the 70s, New Mormon historians sought to bring their professional training to bear on the history of their own tradition. Quinn identifies, using Juanita Brooks's study of Mountain Meadows as a landmark, seven deadly sins of traditional Mormon history that the New Mormon historians sought to avoid: shrinking from controversy, concealing contradictory or sensitive evidence, hesitating to revise traditional explanations and assumptions, using evidence, as some traditional non-Mormon historians had, to insult Mormons' religious beliefs, catering to church public relations preferences, and using history writing as a proselyting tool. New Mormon historians were influenced by their contemporaries, who sought to tell the stories of common people rather than simply focusing on political leaders. When New Mormon historians focused on leaders, Quinn himself is perhaps the best example of this, their unofficial motto was, warts and all. If Mormon historians didn't deal with their own historical difficulties, someone else would, and perhaps without sensitivity or understanding. As is well known, this straightforward approach didn't always curry favor. Camelot rose and fell and then fell once more, largely into an inward-looking obscurity, as work that might have had an impact on larger audiences has become largely produced for internal consumption. Defining cultural history a la Fox and Lear's. Before the 1980s, they explain, critically minded historians usually studied politics and diplomacy, society, and ideas. The turn toward cultural history focused historians' attention on a broader field: the development of vaudeville and film, the rise of the dime novel and literary realism, the spread of a therapeutic mentality of liberal religion, topics that, along with a thousand others, were, when not dismissed outright, relegated to the periphery of the historical enterprise. The term involved a rejection of the positivist faith of 1970s social historians, whose study of common people was laudable, but whose statistical and computer-assisted data crunching was no longer thought to arrive at a final answer to historical questions. Cultural historians, though a diverse lot, turned at least initially from public to private life, from the social to the individual. They began to pay closer attention, influenced by anthropologists and literary critics, on the textuality of historical artifacts, to the ways in which meaning is layered into the documents of all kinds that we use and that we write. Defining cultural studies via the Rutledge Reader on the subject, the movement is most often associated with the British historian Raymond Williams. Dating from the 50s, the movement made a radical break from positivistic or objectivistic modes of inquiry to focus on subjectivity, on culture as experienced by individuals. It was also a highly politicized movement, drawing attention to the origins of social inequality, an emphasis that remained as its practitioners have sought to uncover culture's own political functions. Over time, the political emphasis has shifted to explanations of how certain ideologies gain dominance, usually through consent rather than coercion, in contemporary culture. Scholars working in this mode focus on ways in which culture is broken down into discrete messages signifying practices or discourses, which were distributed by particular institutions and media, such as the ways in which the Marlboro Man contributes to the construction of American masculinity. Cultural studies scholars typically focus on unmasking such media of social dominance or cultural hegemony. Finally, defining new historicism or new literary historicism, courtesy of Gallagher and Greenblatt. Beginning in the 70s, these scholars and others took a historical turn in literary studies, just as cultural historians were taking a literary turn in historical studies. While previous generations of literary critics had sought to isolate texts from their cultural and political context, new historicists wanted to use literary works to understand the past without retaining positivist assumptions about the possibility of objective historical narration. Consequently, new historicism transformed the field of literary studies in several ways. It helped to expand the literary canon by treating lesser works, often ignored works by women and minorities, as inroads to the past as valid as greater or classic works. The newly recovered authors changed our understanding of traditionally canonical works, calling into question assumptions about originality and genius. New historicists also broadened the field examined by literary scholars, bringing canonical works of art into relation not only with works judged as minor, but also with texts that are not by anyone's standard literary, which allowed scholars to suggest surprising or unconventional hidden links between the canon and contemporary popular culture and politics. The movement recast discussions about art into discussions of representation, caused a shift from materialist explanation of historical phenomena to investigations of the history of the human body and the human subject, discovered unexpected context for literary works rather than pursuing overt thematics, and replaced ideology critique with discourse analysis. All of these movements, which hardly can be said to have remained separate from one another, especially in the last 10 years, have something to offer Mormon cultural studies. Their methods, however, are foreign to the project of the new Mormon history and aren't likely to be taken up by the events-oriented generation that founded the movement. Which leads us to the reason for this panel. While some of us probably won't make our careers in the academic study of Mormon culture, others here may. The institution of a Center for Mormon Cultural Studies at UVSC is a hopeful sign. And so, asking someone else to do all the work, I offer my idiosyncratic list of things a new Mormon cultural studies would do that the new Mormon history typically hasn't. 1. Shift the focus from church leaders and official pronouncements, transcendent or ideal or true with a capital T doctrine, to ordinary church members, popular discourse, lived experience, and popular reconstructions and understanding of Mormon theology. Although Mike Quinn is right that the new Mormon history was influenced by the new social history's focus on ordinary people, the majority of Mormon studies remains, at least from my view, preoccupied with the actions and utterances of church leaders, and the underlying debate is always whether or not they were inspired or flawed in human, or both. Rather than argue about the content or truth claims of revelations, for example, why not study the cultural transformations of the Mormon concept of revelation itself? 2. When official pronouncements are studied, they should be viewed less as evidence of Mormon beliefs, generally, than as official pronouncements politically interested. They should be viewed less as events, as if the manifesto changed Mormon beliefs and behaviors regarding polygamy overnight, for example, and more as representation, as texts appropriate for literary and cultural analysis. Matters of faith should be set aside as much as possible or left to devotional essay writing or denominational history, both of which have their place in Mormon life. If faith matters can't be set aside, they should be stated upfront with some recognition of how they affect the analysis to follow. 3. Shift the focus from event to representation generally. Stop worrying what Brother Joseph did on Saturday the 6th and whether or not that proves the priesthood was restored by angels exactly when he said it was. What Jan Shipps refers to as one damn thing after another, history. Focus instead on the stories Mormons create to memorialize such events. 4. Treat diaries and correspondence and books of remembrance, of which Mormons have no shortage, as literary texts. 5. Push it even further. Broaden our range of textual inquiry, remembering the dictum of new literary historicists that all of culture is a text fit for reading. Bring historical and cultural analyses of Mormon literature, art, missionary journals, newspapers, scriptures, official publications, apostate exposés, parades, pageants, institutional forms of worship, food storage, Afterglow albums, Scott Card screenplays for living scripture videos, Jack Whalen novels, BYU fashion shows of the 50s, homefront spots, glass grapes, visitor centers, and Joseph Smith sphinxes in people's backyards to bear on our understanding of Mormon cultural history, on what it means and has meant to claim, resist, experience, and construct Mormon identities. 6. Never lose sight of larger contexts, American or otherwise, in which Mormons live. Just as American historians have had to resist the temptation of narrating an American exceptionalism, Mormon historians can no longer assume Mormon exceptionalism. Certainly we are a peculiar people in every sense, but our peculiarity can only be understood when we realize the degree to which our history has been shaped by larger forces. With these ideas in mind, I'll finish with my own wish list of 10 titles I wish someone else would write. 1. The Returned Missionary Position, A Cultural History of Mormon Sexuality. Here, I'm interested as much in representations of Mormon sexuality from within, in Mormon popular publications, guidebooks for parents, letters, and diaries, and without, in anti-polygamous propaganda and literature, psychological and sociological studies, or even Angels in America or The Real World Nine, as I am in official pronouncements on the matter, if not more so. Certainly official attempts to curtail oral sex are interesting, don't get me wrong, but how effective were they, really? Did they really do half the damage done by four young men only, or for the strength of youth? How, over time, did sex become central to the cultural ritual of the bishop's interview, to BYU student status, to standards nights and seminary soap operas? Why are non-Mormons convinced that sex goes on inside temples, and where do Mormon children get the same idea? Remember, the focus is on representation and cultural construction, not simply on official pronouncement. So how might representations of Mormon sexuality in the Backslider or the Chinchilla Farm refract images of Mormon lasciviousness promoted by Fanny Stenhouse or Zane Grey a century earlier? 2. Tea and coffee and tobacco we despise. Mormon behavior and American culture. The new Mormon historians were interested in economic interpretations or observing that Mormons weren't the only ones talking about temperance in the 1830s. But no one has sufficiently explained, in my mind, exactly how the word of wisdom does, or doesn't, if you want to hold out hope, fit into American cultural patterns from the 1830s to the present. How did original Mormon attitudes differ from those of middle-class reformers? Why did Joseph receive the word of wisdom if it wasn't to be emphasized for another 100 years? Why tea and coffee? What cultural meanings did they have for early Mormons? What lingering associations existed, say, between coffee and the French and tea and the English? Or what of the association between coffee houses and the money elite, or between such places and alcoholic consumption? Why the 1930s is the time to start stressing it? More important and interesting than these questions are issues of cultural representation. When did the word of wisdom infiltrate Mormon popular imaginings? What is the history of postum advertising in the improvement era? What about the cowboy Mormons who never bought into the code? What about contemporary Mormon attitudes toward people, Jack Mormon or not, who drink, smoke, or have a cup of joe in the morning? How is word of wisdom violation represented in Mormon media for teenagers? Have those representations changed over the last 70 years? Is it possible that BYU is surrounded by cafes that only serve hot cocoa? What about BYU scandals over Coke machines in the Tanner Building? And how do all these things fit into larger American attitudes toward the same substances? 3. Mission Stories, the Cultural Work of a Mormon Genre. What cultural work is carried out by composing and transmitting mission stories, both privately among family members, semi-publicly within congregations or missions, and publicly in fiction or movies? What are the mission stories' generic conventions, tropes? Is there a continuum between the folklore documented and studied by Bert Wilson, say, and the average missionary's letters home? What about the missionary dictum, only write what they want to hear? Is there a secret economy among Mormons of mission scandal narratives? The book, I imagine, would explore the literariness of actual letters and journals, as well as mission-centered work by Levi Peterson, Walter Kern, and Bob Elliott. It would confront Orgasmo, as well as Benson Parkinson's novel of the MTC. It would recall the bedtime stories my father generated from his own mission, as well as my own experiences. 4. The Jell-O Belt. Making Mormon foodways. We all know the jokes about Mormon food, but what do they mean? Is there deeper cultural significance to the spread of a ward buffet? What types of ale? Why? What can they tell us about the people who prepare and consume them? How do they differ from other Middle American fare? How have Mormon banquets and barbecues changed over time? How have changes in ward fundraising practices affected community eating events? How did roast with potatoes and carrots emerge as the unofficial Sunday dinner of Mormons? How did the advent of food storage change Mormon menus? What can ward cookbooks tell us about Mormon culture? On this note, Marion Bishop, an NYU English PhD, has already published a terrific essay examining the homemade Mormon cookbook she was given as wedding presents. Jane Manning James, Elijah Abel, and the Construction of Race in 19th Century Mormonism. At the end of the 19th century, many Americans did not consider Mormons to be white. Like the Irish, they were represented in mainstream American media as racially other. While it's worth asking the question how the Mormons became white, it's equally important to ask how these non-white whites became white supremacists. I'm not interested in the theological truths debated over the last 40 years, whether or not God had any hand in the priesthood ban. I'm interested in cultural representations, whether or not Mormons believed their racial doctrines and policies came from God, and how did they represent those beliefs to one another. In keeping with cultural history's tendency to privilege ordinary individuals over cultural leaders, the book, I imagine, would trace the Mormon construction of race and the larger American racialization of Mormonness by working outward from the lives and experiences of two African-American Mormons of the 19th century, Elijah Abel, probably the first black ordained a priesthood office in the restored church, and Jane James, sealed by temple ceremony to the Smith family as a servant. How did freed freed slaves of Mormon converts experience race in Mormon communities? To what degree did Brigham Young's official racism affect the everyday lives of black and white Mormons? How were Mormon attitudes toward race transmitted to later generations? What does a better understanding of racial construction among Mormons offer to an understanding of American racial constructions during the antebellum years, the Civil War, and Reconstruction, both in the Western territories and the states proper? And how might Mormon attitudes have reflected or refracted larger cultural patterns? 6. Fascinating women and fiery feminists, gender and Mormons in 1970s America. We know what happened to Mormon women in the 70s. Church leaders and most female members drew lines in the sand over the ERA as the church in general began a culturally conservative backlash against women's and gay liberation. Some, like Sonia Johnson's Mormons for ERA, were demonized and pushed out of the fold. Michael Quinn has documented official campaigns against the ERA. Marty Bradley has presented a riveting oral history of the Salt Lake International Women's Year Conference. And Brian Cagle and I have attempted to chart the gendered 70s at BYU. What remains is for someone to connect these stories with popular Mormon culture in the decade. Church film strips, music, roadshow scripts, home evening manuals, church magazines. We know what roles leaders wanted members to take, but what really happened in the 1970s? Did Mormon gender roles liberalize more than church members have let on? How did attitudes toward birth control begin to change? What about the founding of Exponent 2 and the flourishing of Mormon women's history? And how do these cultural changes relate to larger American feminist movement and the rise of the moral majority? 7. American domesticity and Mormon polygamy. Did Mormons embrace 19th century American ideologies of domesticity? Were they consumers of domestic fiction and guidebooks? Did polygamist households attempt a separation of spheres? If not, what gender formations emerged, and how did Mormons view themselves in the larger context of American gender norms? What effect, if any, did anti-Mormon representations of polygamy have on the construction of Mormon sexuality? What was the nature of sexual identity among polygamists, the nature of household economy? What domestic advice was dispersed by church leaders, by women's leaders, through channels like the Women's Exponent? How did representations of domestic life in journals and diaries square with official images? And how did Mormon domesticity change with the demise of polygamist households? 8. Communitarian consumption, the cultural construction of class in turn-of-the-century Mormonism. What is the consumer history of the church, the history of advertising and Salt Lake Valley? Where did the United Order end and class formation begin? How were notions of rich and poor bound with the authority of church leadership? Did early Mormons comment on their transition from being the dispossessed of America, Canada, England, and Scandinavian to, for some of them at least, moderately wealthy theocrats in the American West? How long did the fiction of Zion carry plausibility, and when did it begin to be lamented as a lost legacy? When did Mormons begin to blame class difference within Mormon communities on Gentile influence? Where does Salt Lake's labor history fit in the larger American picture of labor strife in the late 1800s? Why did Mormons become anti-union? And when did the wealth equals righteousness equation come into play in popular Mormon discourse? 9. Prophets in the public in early Salt Lake City. What cultural institutions created a notion of civic or public culture as Salt Lake struggled to become a city? What roles were played by the theater, literary and scientific societies, newspapers and magazines? Where did people gather in public to discuss politics, religious or national? On what models were these institutions founded? Did separate public spaces exist for Gentiles and Mormons? Was civic culture separate from religion or subsumed by it? What was the nature of church leaders' public exposure? How was public culture in early Utah gendered, class stratified? To what extent was Salt Lake's public sphere contiguous with or distinct from larger American or Western publics? 10. Queer saints making gay Mormon identities. Official pronouncements and attitudes again form only part of the story, although no one, to my knowledge, has subjected official writing on the subject to queer literary analysis, which might be fun. What are the possible identities available to gay Mormons? How have these identities been affected by official discourse? How have they been embraced or resisted? What histories are waiting to be told about the formation of underground gay communities at BYU? Among missionaries, how has queer Mormonism been represented within and without the church? From Goodbye, I Love You, to For Young Men Only, to Angels in America. How is life as a gay Mormon different for Tim Liu than it was for Mae Swenson? And how does the intersection of gay identity and Mormonism mark both expatriates' poetry? How did Steve Young become the Mormon Tom Cruise? In the wake of... In the wake of Proposition 22, will gay Mormon identities flourish or founder as the choice between sexual and religious identity becomes more rigid, at least from the church's perspective? To what degree does a gay Mormon culture exist independent of larger gay or Mormon cultures? How have Mormon attitudes toward gays and lesbians paralleled or resisted the attitudes of Americans more broadly? What ends are served by official antagonism toward gay rights in the church, and how will anti-gay efforts reshape the religious and social experience of Mormons generally? So that's Brian's top 10, and kind of some background on the cultural studies movement in Mormon studies. And with that, I'd like to turn the time over to Gary Bergera.
I'm using the priesthood there.
Well, it's clear from listening to Brian's talk that I chose to interpret his instructions to us, on the one hand, very conservatively, very narrowly, and to identify the 10 books that I would like someone to write, and on the other hand, very liberally, because I'm identifying the books that I'd like somebody else to write, and they happen to reflect what I would like to see. And so they maybe tell as much about me as they do anything. I assume that we're all here, at least in part, because we love reading. And I'd like to begin with a quote. I read this quote a little earlier in a session that I participated in. But first let me say how much I appreciate being invited to participate on a panel discussing books. For as long as I can remember, books have been an important part of my life. My first job was working for the Provo City Library, reshelving books that had been returned by patrons. I lost that job when it was discovered that I seemed to spend more time reading the books than putting them back on their shelves. If there is any magic left in our secular world, it has to be the effects words can have on us, moving us to tears, to anger, frustration, sadness, joy, laughter, compassion, and especially wonder. Second, I'd like to share this quote with you about books that more than most others articulates my own feelings about this afternoon's topic. The author is Virginia Woolf. The quote is the concluding paragraph from her essay on How Should One Read a Book? For those of you who are listening to this excerpt for the first time, I envy you. Thanks. She concludes this essay by talking about literary critics. If behind the erratic gunfire of the press, the author felt that there was another kind of criticism, the opinion of people reading for the love of reading, slowly and unprofessionally, and judging with great sympathy and yet with great severity, might this not improve the quality of his work? And if by our means, books were to become stronger, richer, and more varied, that would be an end worth reaching. Yet who reads to bring about an end, however desirable? Are there not some pursuits that we practice because they are good in themselves, and some pleasures that are final? And is this reading not among them? I have sometimes dreamt, at least, that when the day of judgment dawns, and great conquerors and lawyers and statesmen come to receive their rewards, their crowns, their laurels, their names carved indelibly upon imperishable marble, the Almighty will turn to Peter and will say, not without a certain envy, when he sees us coming with our books under our arms, look, these need no reward. We have nothing to give them. They have loved reading. I've chosen to interpret Brian's guidelines fairly liberally and have identified both specific books and general categories of books I would like to see written or addressed, preferably by somebody else. Obviously, the books I've identified are works I'd personally like to see undertaken and may be of limited to no interest to anyone else. Parenthetically, however, if any of you have already completed such manuscripts, let's talk afterwards. These books and categories in no particular order are a series of real, full-length, scholarly, well-written biographies, not simply histories of people, to include major figures, and here I probably differ from Brian a little bit, such as all church presidents, Joseph Smith, 3 volumes, Brigham Young, 2 volumes, and all the remaining one volume. And important minor figures, at least minor, relatively speaking, People like James Talmadge, John Widtsoe, B.H. Roberts, Bruce McConkie. A book detailing the 10 best arguments for and against the historicity of the Book of Mormon, as well as rejoinders. And related to this topic, I think an interesting book that we'll see sometime soon is one that deals with the DNA of Native American inhabitants. A scholarly, historically contextualized, heavily documented history of Mormon theology, treating in detail such topics as the Mormon doctrine of deity, the nature of evil, revelation, eternal progression, etc. A history of the Mormon doctrine of God, especially the plurality of gods, Adam God, and Jesus versus Jehovah. A history of Mormon temple worship. Definitive scholarly editions of the original texts of the scriptures, as well as a new, truly scholarly edition of Joseph Smith's own history. A history of Mormon intellectualism during the last half of the 20th century. A history of violence in Mormonism. A history of the family in Mormonism. And finally, a history of the Nauvoo origins of plural marriage that treats not only Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and Heber C. Kimball, but especially the rank and file. That takes care of the 10 books that I'd like to see. It's not very long, and I hope that there's enough time at the end for everybody to ask all the questions that you might have about this topic. And it's a topic that I think is especially interesting. Thanks very much.
A few weeks ago, I was in France for a conference, and I was not thinking about work, and I was not thinking about Sunstone. I was thinking about being in France. And I was walking through Paris, minding my own business, when this thought crossed my mind. Why would someone French choose to be Mormon? This was a random thought, which maybe tells you more about how my brain works than it does anything about Paris. But that thought for me seemed to me to be the beginning of my response to the mandate Brian had given us. Because as I thought about that for the 10 minutes that I allowed, then I went back to being on vacation, it struck me that there's not anything I know of in print that would answer the question in the kinds of ways I would like to see it answered. And I'll come back to that a little bit down the road. There's been a great deal of research on historical particulars, although as Gary's pointed out, there's room for much more. But it seems to me that one of the most important directions that Mormon studies can go, and as Brian talked about in his, what would that be, a prolegomenon of long sentences, that we need to pay more attention to Mormonism as a culture and not simply as a group of people with a history and a group of people with doctrines of various sorts. And I think then of the work of the feminist theologian Rosemary Radford Ruther when she talks about how religious traditions work. Ruther makes the point that what a religion means comes down to how it acquires and has meaning for people, how it shapes and gives voice to their experiences and their thinking. Historical institutions, she writes, create occasions for the experience of the Spirit, but they cannot cause the presence of the Spirit, which always breaks in from a direct encounter of living persons and the divine. Historic institutions also transmit a culture of interpretation around such spiritual encounters. But this culture of interpretation cannot be closed and finalized. It is, at best, an open system of symbolism that gives guidelines to interpret the experience and translate it into daily life. But the living encounter with the Spirit is also the occasion for new appropriation of meaning, by which the given culture of interpretation is itself reinterpreted, renewed, and reshaped. Tradition, to remain alive, must be open to this continual reshaping of interpretive culture by new experience. So it seems to me that the big culture question, and I tend to start with the big question and then get to the specific books, is what does it mean to be Mormon, with the emphasis on the word be? Being Mormon means different things to different people. I think that's clear in the responses in the last year to the film God's Army and to the book Leaving the Fold, each of which recount or give a representation of people's experiences of being Mormon, each of which have had people respond to that representation by saying, that's exactly right, or saying, that's so bizarre, I don't recognize it, nobody I know had that experience, how could that be the case? Brian, in his piece, mentioned that cultural studies has emphasized subjectivity, looking at how people experience the world, looking at the cultural categories, the vocabularies, the tools of representation they use to make sense of their world, of their experiences, of their lives. I think there's a great deal of work to be done there. In certain ways, in fact, I suspect that we have a clearer idea of what it meant to be a Mormon in the 19th century, when Mormonism conceived of itself as separate from the rest of society and had certain kinds of millennial ambitions, than perhaps we have in our own 20th century, when Mormonism reinvented itself as quintessentially American and middle class, and what was Mormon and what was American became a little bit hazier in certain kinds of ways. I'm not entirely persuaded that's true, but I think there's something to it. What about the 21st century? That's going to be interesting to see, as there is a wider disparity in certain ways among the life experiences that are called Mormon, as more and more people and higher percentage of church members live entire lives, live multiple generations of families far from the Mormon culture region, in postmodern societies, in societies generally that are wary of authority and of truth claims. So it'll be interesting to see. A couple of key questions, and then I'll tell you my 10 books, some of which are more serious than others. The key questions, with nods to the work of Ruther, which I mentioned, and to Colleen McDaniel's work on Mormons and material culture. What do the rituals of religion, from the everyday ones to the once-in-a-lifetime, mean to Mormon participants? Why do they mean what they mean, and how do those meanings work? How do they change through time? We all have an idea, in some cases, of what certain kind of religious practices are intended to mean, what people are told they're to mean. But what do they actually mean to the people who do them? What does it mean to someone to be baptized? What does it mean to an 8-year-old? What does that mean to a person 20 years later, 30 years later, 40 years later? One of my nieces is going to be baptized tomorrow, and I was just at a family reunion, and there were various discussions of who would be there, whether it mattered if other people were there, if it mattered dramatically to an 8-year-old, to which one adult member of the family said, I have no idea who was there when I was baptized. I don't know if it mattered to me when I was 8. Maybe it probably did, but I, you know, now I don't know. I remember vaguely, she said, but... So the intended meaning versus the experienced meaning. There's a big gap there, a big gray zone. How does that work? How does the difference, Brian mentioned again the example of what you eat or drink, make a difference in your experience of being Mormon? People often like to reject the idea that religion is like a cafeteria where you choose some things and not others. People will say, well, you know, religion doesn't work that way. Ideologically, their point is clear. You're handed a system, you're told this is, it all comes together, it's all woven together. But practically speaking, that is how religion works. Some aspects of the religion appeal to people more than others. Some connect with them, some resonate with them, some offer meaning to people at some points in their lives, but they do not offer meaning to other people's, not at that point in time, or maybe a little later, or maybe in a different way. People often tend to dismiss views other than their own with, well, that's not the gospel. Well, that may be not be the gospel to that person, but to someone else it may be the heart of the gospel as they experience it. Terry Tempest Williams, in her new book, Leap, tells an anecdote of two children each being asked what was their favorite gospel principle. To a child, in a way, this is not only perhaps a favorite, but what seems to you to be the heart of the gospel, and she sets up the anecdote this way. One child answers obedience. The other child answers free agency. Those are two really, really different versions of the gospel. So how does, finally, the last key question I would say is, how does Mormonism as a religious culture evolve in varied and new contexts? Brian's examples came very often from 19th and early 20th century American culture. That reflects his academic training. My academic background is in the 20th century. How does 20th century Mormon culture interact in the various contexts in where it finds itself? The late 20th century Mormon emphasis on the middle class American family as a religious unit. How does that play out in people's lives in the U.S., in Maine, in Chile? What about China? What about the Ivory Coast? How is this going to change as other countries have multiple generations of Mormon families and as the culture is adapted there? Okay, enough of the general questions. Let me mention 10 books. The first, I started from the bottom up, so the 10th book, I don't remember why, it was maybe after watching Letterman. The 10th book is Hoop Dreams, Basketball, Square Dance, and American Mormonism. This evening, Claudia Bushman is going to be talking about the Church of the 40s and 50s that sponsored a very large cultural life. While that church has largely disappeared, there remain vestiges. We are, to my knowledge, the only denomination that has basketball courts attached to chapels in almost every building. There's something to be said about that, and I'd like someone fonder of basketball than I to say it. Okay, number 9, I'm Okay, You're Not. In 1975, I first went on a trip to Europe with a group of high school students in a choir. I went to high school in Boise. Several students in the choir were Mormon, although most were not. While I was walking through St. Peter's in Rome, being overcome by the experience of being in this grand, immense building, I heard a creepy sound. The creepy sound was one of the guys in our group humming, "Come, Come, Ye Saints." This seemed only creepy because I was in Rome, and this was St. Peter's. A couple of us asked him what was going on, and he said that he was too uncomfortable being in the building. He was at the heart of the center of what I think he had grown up thinking of as the evil empire, and he started humming "Come, Come, Ye Saints" to comfort him. This has stuck in my mind as an emblem of the widespread Mormon discomfort with anybody and anything who is not Mormon, the tendency to categorize into members and non-members, to say, "I'm okay, you're not." So I think there's a lot to be said about that discomfort. Number 8, girl groups and boys clubs. Mormon culture, officially and unofficially, has a massive gender divide. From the age of 10 until death, the chief religious education occurs in segregated classes, boys and girls, men and women. When you stop and think about it, there's something about this that is utterly bizarre. And I think we ought to talk about why. And more importantly, perhaps we ought to talk about what the effects are of doing this. I have noticed that when people suggest getting rid of something so they don't have 3 hours of church, they always suggest Sunday school. At the same time, I don't know too many people, particularly people my age and younger, who have expressed fondness for priesthood meeting or relief society. Okay, number 7, pioneer envy, or the cult of the pioneers. I revere the exhaustive efforts of my pioneer ancestors as much as anyone else does, but it makes me uncomfortable that we mythologize and sacralize their experience to the point that they bear little resemblance to human beings, and that we somehow set them up in comparison to what people do in the 20th century. Pioneer stories are powerful stories. I'm curious what ends they are used to in our culture. The myth-making that we do about pioneers, the ways in which pioneer stories and the possession of them in one's own family is used in an exclusionary kind of way in the church. The larger question, I think, here is how the myths we tell about ourselves are quite revealing. Number 6, contemplating our modestly covered and definitely unpierced navels. This topic is about Mormon self-absorption. I think Mormons are more preoccupied with themselves than almost anybody else I know. And I speak from long experience. Mormons are really incredibly fascinated by things like who famous is Mormon, who famous is rumored to be Mormon, who famous might have been tracked out by their friends, cousins, dogs, neighbors, missionary companions, cousin, and they talked to him once. There are websites that go up about Mormonism that have a page on famous Mormons, and they all seem to, and they are all the same people, and we already knew they were Mormon. Mormons are preoccupied with how they are represented elsewhere. I said I went to high school in Boise. When we moved there, there were people in the ward who would not didn't like how it represented Mormons. This meant that they chose wholesale ignorance on local politics rather than articles that they occasionally didn't like. Now, it wasn't a good paper. It's a Gannett paper. I didn't like it anyway. But the larger point is choosing the preoccupation with how Mormons are represented and caring about it to such an enormous degree. It seems to me that this is a weakness of the culture and in some ways a sign of its immaturity that may too easily extend to Mormon critical thinking, a preoccupation with Mormonism as the center of the universe that misses the larger context that Brian mentioned that are so critically a part of who Mormons are, national culture, class, ethnicity, their point in economic history, all kinds of things like that. Okay, a little bit more seriously. Five books, those five books I would thoroughly enjoy. The next five are books I really think ought to be written. I'd like them all, actually. I forgot my visual aid for number five. Number five is Mormon Material Culture, My Life, My Kitsch. And here I owe a debt to Colleen McDaniel and also to Jana Reese's recent article in Sunstone the debris you can buy at Mormon stores, the bumper stickers, the action figures, the jewelry, all those sorts of things. Why and how do these objects have meaning for people? CTR rings have been talked about an awful lot. My own topic, were I to write this book, which I'm not going to, would be bandalos. And I only wish that I had my bandalo, I would have worn it. While I date myself by saying this, I think I was in the last year of people who got to finish their bandalos. And there was a time when I wanted every one of those rhinestones badly. My mother's in the room, and she can attest if she remembers that I once, on a vacation, forced my family to take me to primary in Manhattan so I could get my last rhinestone in my bandalo. Okay, it mattered. Then another chapter on this would be about the shattered dreams of the girls 1 and 2 years younger than I, including one of my sisters, who had started their bandalos. The Mary Miss program was started, and they were allowed never to finish them. They were left with bandalos with just a few rhinestones, 1 or 2 little plastic doohickeys glued on, and this was traumatic. You laugh. You didn't see the look on my sister's face. Okay, this is a sad thing. Okay, I tell you about bandalos because a friend and I once had plans to do a whole newsletter, and fortunately, we got back our sensibility. But the larger topic here is, what do these things mean to us, these material objects that we have from Mormonism? Numbers 4 and number 3 are a tie. I couldn't decide which was more important, and I did need to come to the room, so I just left it as a tie. The first of these I'll mention is Gendering Mormons, replaying the 1950s, replaying the 1930s, replaying 1910, replaying the 19th century. How does this deeply gendered culture work in North America and elsewhere? To begin with, imagine, as Dialogue did in the 1970s, a ward in which all jobs and duties are reversed. Church is conducted by a woman, the sacrament is served by girls, the last speaker is a man, I haven't been real recently. Okay, the last speaker is a woman, and the man who speaks before her tells about their courtship and how they met. She speaks about the godhood. I also didn't get quite enough sleep last night. And everything has changed, the theology as well. There's a great deal of talk about God the Mother. This goes on, and it says, and she has a husband, you know. If you just think about a church meeting, and I encourage you to do this for even a few minutes, you realize that there's a great long, long distance to go. And I would suggest a growing divide as women's voices are valued in their workplaces, their communities, and their families, but the church is replaying the 50s and the 30s and so on in many ways. Not in every way, of course, but in many ways. I would like to see a book on how young girls and boys negotiate Mormonism and how they make it their own or don't make it their own as they become adults. Tied with this, I would like us to see books on, and this is a, here I'm cheating like Gary and doing categories of books. I'd like to see books on national and ethnic identities in Mormon culture. In a church run primarily by Western North Americans from the middle class, I think we have a myopia regarding the depth of ethnic and national identity and allegiances. So many examples could work here. If we think our perceptions of 20th century Mormonisms are so much of a suburban middle class American church, what happens when that church goes to other places. There is very little in print on non-English-speaking Mormon culture. There is some. There are mission histories, there are some accounts of that, but what about the culture? What happens as the culture goes to other places and parts of it are adapted and parts are rejected? Second, I would like, number two, my next to last one, I would like to see something about Mormons and the conservative turn in American culture. In my childhood, the church closest to Mormonism, in a real literal way, it was across the street, was the Episcopalian Church. I find it fascinating and not a tad creepy that in my lifetime, Mormonism has moved closer not to Episcopalians, but to the Southern Baptists, with whom we now share the dubious distinction of proudly having pre-modern views about women in the ministry. How and why did this occur? How, and this is the larger question, how is the church changing as members come from more conservative institutions? They come to it, for instance, from the Southern Baptist Church. I have a family member whose ward includes people who joined the church after previously being in the Klan. The reason they joined the church was that it had better youth programs. Well, the Klan has youth programs. I'm glad ours are better, but still, you know. What about the conservative turn? What has happened in the last 40 years? Or to put it very simply and in a kind of cliched way, will Mormon culture ever get over the 1960s? My last topic, number one, and actually the one that is the one I'd most like to read, with reading as a pleasure in the way Gary talked about. There's not quite enough material here for the book I'd like to see, but I think there soon will be. This book would be called The New Mormon Autobiography. In the 1990s, there was a boom in American autobiographical writing and a hint of its beginning in Mormon culture. This is not the dutiful life story writing that Brian mentioned in his piece, but a kind of honest and frank and fresh kind of memoir about the way Mormon culture is one of many threads shaping modern Mormon lives. Not the definitive framework, but one of many threads. These are books about being Mormon in specific times and places. We've had many years of personal essays in Exponent 2 and Dialogue. I would mention in particular that a few books from the last decade, Phyllis Barber's How I Got Cultured, Terry Tempest Williams' Refuge and Leap, and Michael Gilmore's Shot in the Heart. These books are powerful because they tell stories of individual lives' intersections with Mormonism, which shows up in those lives in various ways: family, myth, faith, folklore, prohibition, answers, questions. These are books in which people look at their experience of Mormonism reflectively and critically. It's not just contemplating their own navel. Mormon readers may not recognize the strains of Mormonism that appear in other Mormon autobiographical writing. I must say that I myself often do only from a distance. But that makes it all the more powerful because it demonstrates that even if we don't think that is the case, there is always already a broad diversity in how people live the religion. And perhaps someday there will be a French Mormon autobiography that'll answer my question.
The nice thing about going last is that many of my ideas have already been covered, but hopefully I can add some different insights. In a sort of Japanese fashion, I'm going to start out with an apology, and that is that my field of study is so distant from Mormon studies and even cultural studies that I'm not sure what has been written, but these are things that I would like to see written, and if they have been written, you can suggest them to me. The second thing is, when I talked with Brian, this panel was only 5 titles instead of 10 titles, so I've been trying to come up with some other things or other ideas that I'd like to do. So I have some titles and just some categories or ideas. And how I'd like to sort of structure my comments is, first of all, tell you why my own interest in this is, where it's coming from, and why I think it would be beneficial to write. The first book that I would really like to see is a book maybe titled Public Polygamy. In my own studies, I've looked at Asian polygamy, and for the most part, polygamous societies, the women are kept very separate from the public world. However, in Mormon polygamy, that was very different. With the men going off on missions and not being around, women played an important public and social role. And what is that? how does that affect the nature of polygamy when the women are not cordoned off in their own separate quarters, but actually an integral part of society? I would be very interested in seeing something done on this topic, and I'd also be interested in putting polygamy in a greater context of 19th century marriage. How fulfilling were 19th century monogamous marriages? Were frontier marriages any more supportive of women than a polygamous marriage? And instead of focusing on the questions of is polygamy true or not true, again, look at culturally at marriage and how polygamy featured as an aspect of marriage in the 19th century. A second book that I would like to see is maybe something that could be titled The Emasculation of the Masculine Man and the Masculinization of the Emasculated Man. What this means is, I teach priesthood and I've been enjoying going over the writings of Joseph F. Smith, and one of the more interesting quotes on mother was a quote that Joseph F. Smith talked about where he says, "The closest person I've ever known to my father and my own mother." And I was sort of shocked by this juxtaposition of here's a masculine figure and only a woman is able to measure up to this masculine figure, and how that plays in the construction of what is a man. And the church has a great wealth of magazines for youth, for MIA and other programs starting from the very beginning, and it would be a very easy process to go through and see how masculine behavior and feminine behavior were constructed throughout these magazines as they were used to train youth, and moreover, how you take what is sort of the Mormon ideal of manhood as being a very polite, good boy, and contrast that to the sort of American ideal of manhood of being sort of this rough guy that sort of gets everything he wants, and the rugged individualist, and how that affects how a man perceives himself. And this is something, again, when I bring it up in priesthood meeting, that the men are really trying to figure out as they want to be aggressive in the careers, and yet at the same time they want to be good fathers. So this is a real dilemma, I think, for many men, is what does it mean to be a good Mormon man and a good American man, and what is this history of how the church has viewed masculinity beginning at the very start of the church to the present. A third book, which has sort of been mentioned, and I would probably maybe title it From Peculiar People to Christians, as in, again, the more religious right, and why has the church gone towards more of the religious right, and the proliferation of, for lack of a better word, talismans that the religious right uses, such as what would Jesus do bracelets. My child came home from primary with a what would Jesus do bracelet, and I was sort of surprised because I would never have had one of those. I was of the era of the Vandalos as well, and thought it was wonderful to be able to put my article of faith stickers on this fake plastic piece of leather, and having the targeteer module that you put each face of the prophets on. And a lot of my religious primary education was focused on these sort of cultural touchstones that disappeared with the consolidation. And I think in many ways, our youth are looking for ways to identify themselves as Mormons, but instead of coming up with their own ways, they're borrowing what the religious right are using. And I was in Lagoon the other day, and there were people wearing, you know, 10,000 or 2,000 stripling warrior shirts everywhere. And that's another new sort of Mormon cultural icon that is completely foreign to me, having grown up in the church in the 70s, and as well as CTR rings. So, again, why are these talismans becoming so popular? And is it a lack because there's some official group of things that I had when I was going through primary? A fourth idea is a notion, again, that comes from the Joseph F. Smith book, is that there was a quote talking about the world going to hell in a handbasket and how we need to gird ourselves up and protect ourselves from the world. And it was a quote from a talk that was given like in 1906. And the rhetoric in that talk was so similar to the rhetoric that we're hearing today, and it's the rhetoric that I've heard read when I study, you know, the end of the Japanese regime that I'm studying, the same sorts of things, that the world has become immoral and we need to stand true. And what is it that particular rhetoric means to people, and how does it inspire this sort of persecution mentality, especially in a time when Mormons, they are persecuted by the religious right in some ways, but you have Steve Young giving the opening or the closing prayer at the National Convention. I mean, Mormons and Mormonism, to me, have hit the mainstream in a way that they never have before. A fifth book I would sort of like to see is, I called it, What Does the Celestial World Look Like? And it would be a cultural history of the interior decoration of celestial rooms. The first time I went through the temple, I went through the Salt Lake Temple, and the celestial room of the Salt Lake Temple didn't strike me as that odd, but I went through about 10 years later, and it was very strange to move from room to room where you have the natural world, and then all of a sudden you're in the celestial room where there's absolutely nothing natural about it, complete with a woman with a bundle of sheaths standing over where the veil comes through. But then I contrast that with the other temple that I'm most familiar with, which is the Ogden Temple, which the celestial room sort of looks like, you know, a Fairfield Marriott lobby. And what does, as we build more and more temples, what does this supposedly most sacred space and how it is decorated, how it is designed, what does that culturally mean to people? Because that is, in a way, the celestial room of the Salt Lake Temple was the way they must have envisioned the celestial kingdom in order to decorate it that way. So I think an architectural historian, an art historian, if they could write something on that, it would be a very interesting topic for me. Another topic which Brian has sort of touched upon, this is more of a category, but I'm interested in looking at a religion that at one time, in sort of a Brigham Young sense, sought to provide all aspects of culture and society. There was a playhouse, there was the Deseret Gym. It was aimed at sort of creating the whole human. Well, the church has sort of, you know, done away with the road shows, the plays, they've done away with the Deseret Gym in a big way, and seem to be, as the church has grown larger, out of necessity, concentrated on what may be considered just spiritual things, and have allowed us to turn to the world for these more cultural aspects. What are the problems of doing that, and how does that affect what we think or how we view our own Mormonism? I would also be interested in a topic that I would call Church, Where Is Thy Sting? And what it is sort of removing the worldly stumbling blocks of membership. And again, what I mean by that is, how would our church today be differently if we were still asked to live the law of consecration, if we were still asked to live polygamy? This polygamy question is something very interesting, because I have talked with wives that say there will be absolutely no polygamy in the celestial kingdom, where their husbands are say, of course there's going to be polygamy in the celestial kingdom. And by taking important tenets and not disavowing them, but saying we are going to be practicing them in some future date, allows people to sort of, again, pick and choose in a smorgasbord way of, I can believe this because it's not required of me to believe right now. A more recent aspect of this was the removal of the penalties from the temple film. And it's difficult, it's interesting talking with younger people who have gone to the temple, because they don't believe those penalties were ever in them. And they're sort of amazed that when you say that, yes, I've experienced those, that they say, no, they wouldn't have been in there. And so maybe even a history chronicling the changes in a readable way, and how and what are the meanings of these changes culturally for people. I personally sort of like the penalties because they were very strange and really did separate us apart, but I could understand how they could be stumbling blocks to other people. I would be interested in looking at along the lines of Brian, and this comes from there was a Japanese embassy that came through Salt Lake City in the 1870s, and were sort of stuck in Salt Lake City for about a month because there had been an avalanche, and the United States government was so afraid of leaving the Mormons in Salt Lake City that Stanford offered to ship them around Terra del Fuego to bring them up to Washington, D.C. rather than have them stay in Salt Lake City, but the Japanese insisted on being there. It's interesting to see what they did during that month in Salt Lake. They were sort of bored, but they'd go to hot springs, but they also went to the theater. So it'd be interesting to see what sorts of plays were presented and what the themes of these plays were. Because I think, again, different idea of what is acceptable for us to be seeing nowadays. When teaching from the Brigham Young Manual, I thought it was very interesting when he'd say, you know, there can be horrible things in them as long as the end moral was good. as opposed to today where everything has to be nice and they kind of have horrible things in them, which sort of infantilizes entertainment. You can't have great things because we're trying to shun the appearance of evil. But that seems to be very different from what Brigham Young was saying in these certain quotes. So what were these plays like that were being produced in Salt Lake City in the 1860s and 1870s? I think it would be interesting to have a look at the letters and the diaries of Mormons who went to war, whether it be the Spanish-American War, the First World War, World War II. Again, going from a church that was persecuting, a church being persecuted by the government, to all of a sudden being called to serve in your government, what were your feelings during those times? And look at sort of what was the American view towards war. Another sort of topic, and this may be sort of going out on a limb in a way, but and I mean this somewhat disparagingly, but not in the sense that hopefully you'll take it, but sort of the relief societization of the priesthood. In other words, taking the priesthood from being what was conceived as the ruling body of each ward to putting it on par with the relief society where the men just go there and talk about things and the real government of the ward takes place in another council. So instead of pulling out the relief society to be on par with the priesthood, this notion of pulling the priesthood back down to be on level with the relief society, and even though every male member now has the priesthood, some people's priesthood seems to be more equal than other people's priesthood. And what is the process and what does that mean? And I would be sort of interested in the cultural development of that notion. Anyway, I don't know if I've covered 10 or not, but these are some of the books that I would like to see that sort of pinpoint some of the questions that I have studying the 19th century and contrasting the 20th century church with the 19th century church. Thank you.
So the rest of the time, I guess we have about 20 minutes, it's open for discussion. So if anybody has any questions or any books they'd like to see to offer up, it looks like we've got somebody here and then in the back.
The question hopefully is going to be brief. Specifically for Gary, did I understand correctly that you say Mormonism and violence?
Yeah, I think that a good history of violence in Mormonism, I think those of you, probably the best thing that's available today is in the second volume of Mike Quinn's Extensions of Power, where he talks about a culture of violence. And as thorough as that is, it an expansion on that that talks about violence within its own context in the 1820s and 30s and 40s and on, as well as the Mormon reaction to that, which I think is a legacy that we live with today.
There was a gentleman in the back and then over there.
Well, I'm going to come up so that this gets out of my... I have a preamble, I'm sorry. But I think it was back in the 70s, there was a television show called Real People. Anybody remember that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, anyway, that's when they did the Nielsen ratings, and they interviewed a Nielsen family, happened to be living in Utah. I think I was in Chicago at the time, so it was when I was a teenager. And they went into their home, and they had their living room television set tuned to PBS, but they were in the den watching other things. And it sounds like a lot of these titles are things you wish would be read. You know, you'd buy, and they'd sit on your bookshelf for a couple of years until you got around reading them. What would be the titles that you would read tonight if they were available? I mean, mine would be Sex, Lies, and What Goes On Behind Closed Doors Among the General Authorities. But which ones would you actually read rather than wanting to be on somewhere for you to get around to reading at some point in the future?
Somebody want to take that one?
I would actually read every book I listed, but the ones I would read most eagerly and most quickly and would probably sit down, open the package, sit down and read them and kind of, you know, clean the house a couple days later would be not the critical analysis of New Mormon autobiographies, but New Mormon autobiographies of the kind I described. The books I mentioned I found extremely interesting to read and in some cases quite powerful, and those are the ones I'd read first, and then I'd read the others.
Well, I felt the same way. I mean, everything that I put down there, I really they're honest. You know, they're books that I really would read. You know, the Brian could have asked us to address the question 10 books that we would like somebody else to read that would sell in sufficient quantities to justify publishing. Oh, and it's not just physical violence either. I mean, I think that you see a shift in, and that's why I think there's still a legacy that we live with.
When well, that's why you wish someone else would write it.
When I was at BYU in the late 70s, one of my teachers was John Sorensen, and he'd been hired by the church to write one of the sesquicentennial history volumes, and I think he was doing a cultural history of Mormonism in the 20th century, and that would have been one of the topics that he would have written about if he'd written his book.
No, one person I know, a woman.
Release the scientization. Could you elaborate on that?
Before you what? Well, you may want to go ahead and attack. This is more of a personal feeling that I've had, and I really haven't given the thought. I just know that it feels like priesthood meeting. I mean, I think in the beginning, my sense is that both Relief Society and priesthood have a lot more power than they do in the present-day church. And I'm just interested that priesthood meeting has become much more like Relief Society, where it never seemed, back before the consolidated block, it seemed to be different. But it's more of a scent than Relief Society. That there's... Yeah. And my point is that both Relief Society and priesthood should be more discussing the affairs of the church instead of what they're doing now, in a way.
You know,
it was
crummy.
No, it was.
I thought the Relief Society was a lot more interesting.
Well, a blessing and unique. And unique. Yeah.
Circle
the chairs, that made a big difference.
This sort of raises, I think, another interesting cultural idea, and that is, why do women spend so much time in preparing Relief Society, where men typically will throw something together 5 minutes before the lesson?
Yeah, that sounds
yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, this is a much more complex problem. I think there would be some good things that the priesthood could get from the Relief Society, but I was talking more in the power structure of the church rather than... at a cultural level, but I agree with you that I think Relief Society lessons are, for the most part, prepared much better than priesthood lessons. But again, the question is, why is that? Why do women feel the need to have the lace tablecloth and the flowers to be stereotypic, although they may all not be that way, or the little cookies that have something written on them that they pass out, where the men don't?
That's our only
avenue. In the green. Okay. Yeah, that may be, but just in my own experience with Relief Society lessons is that it's not so much, I mean, and this sounds very touchy-feely again, it's not so much what is said in the lesson, but kind of the support that you gather, and I think that was originally a large purpose of the Relief Society, was to give women a place to go and kind of commune, and I think it doesn't work as well as it used to, because our lives are so fragmented and church is not the center anymore. In the floral dress.
Yeah, well, can you talk about...
I think he was saying it was being handled somewhere else.
No, I'm saying more in a 19th century vision, where the men, for better or worse, were thought to be in control of what was going on. The priesthood forms were more than just one more avenue of instruction.
So it sounds like gender was a pretty big issue. Okay.
I guess I'd like to change the subject. I guess
thank you.
That'd be fine.
Okay. I've been in France for 2.5 years.
But why would being American make you more predisposed to be Mormon? I'm interested in that. The benefit?
Well, just to respond to a little of that, part of the reason I used the French example is because that's when I started thinking of things for the panel. But... near the end of what I was talking about, I mentioned sort of national and ethnic identities more generally. We often talk about sorting out what's American culture and what's the gospel. And I think most of us, most of the time, could agree that basketball is not an eternal principle, but faith is, or something like that. But where exactly do you draw some of those lines? Is it important that Mormon children in every country celebrate Pioneer Day? If so, how? If so, in what kind of way? And if there comes a time as the church goes to different countries and it gradually is sorted out which things work in those countries, which things seem to be elements of the church that go there, and which things seem very American, like the whole daytimer thing. It seems to be, and the seven, what's that, seven habits of, right. That seems to have become an almost authoritative part of a lot of American Mormonism, but those are easy ones to sort out. How does the culture in the Ivory Coast intersect with what comes from the Western United States as Mormon culture? I think that there are an awful lot of books to be written there, and an awful lot of questions to be asked to answer my question, to answer your question of 35 years, and to answer questions that I'm sure anyone who has extensive experience in another country is going to have. Who joins the church in other countries? Are they people who are already comfortable with American culture? Are they people who have come from a macho culture and find the church's view of gender roles particularly appealing or satisfying? Is it someone for whom a friend said a while ago that she could see in her family history the point where being Mormon was a sign of their social mobility, their upward mobility. And I think in many countries, Mormonism is a middle-class religion that promises a middle-class life to people. She said she also saw a point where being Mormonism was a hindrance to social mobility in her American family because of certain kinds of intellectual aspirations. So how do cultures interact? I just think there's an enormous amount of work to be done there.
If I could just add something, I think we also need to sort of look at a monolithic notion of culture as well. I know that in Japan, many of the people who joined the church are people who are rejecting their Japanese identity for a while, and there's something about the American culture that is very appealing to them. And so it's not so much that they're joining the Mormon church, but they're joining an American church. And they don't last all that long, but that is another... You need to look at who are the people that are joining as well as...
The reasons
that they're... those are tied together, but not just a French identity versus an American identity.
One of the things that some of the people Brian cited in his paper who have done cultural studies work on people's experiences in the U.S. and Britain have talked about is that middle-class white Americans very commonly in, say, the last 20 years will have the sentiment, I have no ethnicity, I have no culture. My life is this sort of bland white bread norm. Other people have culture. So you get people who kind of want to be and have Native American religion, or want to be black, or whatever, and are drawn to find an ethnic ancestry origin that has a great deal of appeal to them. And I think it's perhaps because of that sentiment that we think of our identity as being Mormon or American in a sort of vague kind of way. I think especially Western American Mormons often underestimate how deeply ethnicity and national identity matter deeply to people in other countries. Like you were saying about wanting to reject Japanese identity, or you were saying about American students saying, I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. I know among my students, often their response to, say, political conflict in the former Yugoslavia is, well, they should all just get over that and grow up and be like me. Now, there's a certain problem with this, and that's a teaching moment. But that suggests a great naivete about how deeply people's identities are shaped by national and ethnic identities, and that Mormonism, if it comes there, that people will abandon that and become Mormon is an awfully naive way to think. I think.
Go ahead.
I haven't heard anybody talk about that.
Okay, I'll talk about it. I wouldn't discount that. as being a factor in people joining a religion, that they read something, that they were influenced, that they were touched, that something moved them, and they felt this was the right thing to do. But I think that looking at the cultural factors that influence people, even from things like how it is that someone would read a book and would find that a sufficiently decisive reason to make the dramatic changes in life that would be required by joining this religion, I think cultural explanations can help us to account for a lot of that. If one's goal is, for instance, to increase convert baptisms, I think knowing how it is that people respond to the cultural aspects of the church would be just as important as knowing how they respond to the spiritual message, because the spiritual message can move people very deeply, but it is often culture that keeps people in or keeps people out day after day when they're there, week after week, year after year. So I think whatever...